Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And now we turn to the biz page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Dig This is the article, UNC Researchers Find 1,600-Year-Old Mosaic in Israel. A team of UNC Chapel Hill archaeologists has unearthed a 1,600-year-old mosaic, shedding light on a period of ancient Jewish faith. Professor Jody Magnus has led a team each summer for 9 years in the ancient village of Hukok in Israel's Lower Galilee. This time, they discovered mosaics and the remains of an ancient synagogue, notably depicting four beasts described in the Book of Daniel. Another mosaic depicts a story of Elam found in the Book of Exodus. The depictions are some of the earliest known representations of the biblical tales and leave researchers wondering why the latter was so important to the Jewish congregation. Our work sheds light on a period when our only written sources about Judaism are rabbinic literature from the Jewish sages of this period and references in early Christian literature, she said. Early Christian literature is generally hostile to Jews and Judaism, so archaeology fills this gap by shedding light on aspects of Judaism between the 4th to 6th centuries CE, about which we would know nothing otherwise. And under the heading of Bus Stop comes the article, This School Bus is the Place to Be for North Carolina Vacationers. So, where did you spend the 4th of July? In a school bus? Turns out, a recent ranking by Airbnb of its most wished listed accommodations for 20 of the most visited North Carolina counties includes a school bus that's been turned into a place to stay not far from downtown Shelby. A couple turned the 1983 school bus into a place it sleeps for and has a restroom. It rents for $50 a night. And under the heading of Keeping the Lights On comes the article, Durham Company Helps Light Up New York. Durham-born technology is taking on Times Square. Samsung Electronics just completed a massive 5-screen LED display at New York City's One Times Square building. It equates to a display that's nearly 12,000 square feet, and Cree supplied the LED components. In a tweet July 1st, Cree said it was honored to be chosen for the job and hoping to keep the lights shining bright in one of America's iconic locations. And keep in mind that it's only another 6 months until it's time for New Year's Eve. And under the heading of Service comes the article, Tammy Lynn Center celebrates a milestone. Break out all the gold things. July 2nd was the Golden Jubilee of the Tammy Lynn Center for Developmental Disabilities as the nonprofit celebrated 50 years as an incorporated entity. The nonprofit has grown from what was dubbed a Mom's Morning Out in the basement of a church in Cary in 1969 to its present location on Chapel Drive in Raleigh. The organization now provides an array of services, including early intervention, education, housing, therapy, and respite care. Its latest 990 tax form shows total revenue for TLC Operations Incorporated at $8.2 million. And under the heading of New Job comes the article, This TBJ honoree has been busy since he turned 40. How's this for a 40 under 40, where are they now? On June 28th, Rodney Hood attended a ceremonial swearing-in of his role as chairman of the National Credit Union Administration, officiated by U.S. Vice President Mike Pence. Hood, who was one of the Triangle Business Journal's 40 under 40 winners in 2004, was appointed chairman of the board of the National Credit Union Administration by President Donald Trump in January. Hood, now 52, I served as a member of the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Visitors and as a member of the Board of Governors for the UNC system, as well as several other board positions. Hood had previously served on the NCUA board under President George W. Bush. A hearty congrats from Biz to a 40 under 40 alumnus. And under the heading of Summer Trend comes the article, Teens Roll Their Eyes as Mom and Dad Say, Go Get a Job. There are plenty of signs around Triangle Pools this summer urging teenagers to apply to be lifeguards, and those signs reflect a larger trend. A recent Pew Research Center report says summer employment for Americans from the age of 16 to 19 is remarkably low, despite the strong economy. Last summer, for example, only 34.6% of teens in that age group had jobs. Data dating to the 1940s shows a pattern in which summer teen employment rises with strong economies and ebbs when the economy suffers. In 1989, for example, 57% of teens had summer jobs, but that dropped to 30% in 2010 and 2011 during the Great Recession. The numbers have only inched upward despite the roaring economy. Pew researchers say factors could include lower skill level, entry-level jobs, more teens taking summer classes, or more interest in unpaid internships. The Pew Research also found some interesting differences by race. Last summer, Pew found the summer employment rate for whites was 37.5%, followed by 28.9% for Hispanics, 25.8% for blacks, and 20.1% for Asians. Next, we turn to the technology and transportation page in this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of He Said It comes the article, Wake Stone Addresses Legislative Amendment. In an email amid debate over a legislative amendment that would exempt Raleigh-Durham International Airport from certain buffer rules, Sam Bratton, president of Wake Stone Corporation, fired back at his critics. Despite what activists have said about plans for the Odd Fellows Tract, he said Wake Stone doesn't plan to mine adjacent acreage known as the 286 Tract. Wake Stone is not involved in the effort to exempt RDU from Noose River buffers, he said. This issue is in regard to their parking expansion. It does not pertain to our permitting effort to mine the Odd Fellows property. Second, Wake Stone has never intended, nor will ever attempt to mine the 286 Tract. I don't think I can be any clearer. And under the heading of Different Views comes the article, Report Criticizes Cost of Complete 540 Project. Complete 540 is ranked among an annual list of highway boondoggles, one of nine transportation projects expected to cost a combined $25 billion. Public Interest Research Group claims the planned six-mile highway extension around southern Raleigh would cause sprawling development and troubling environmental damage. Here's how some reacted. We agree that the Complete 540 project is a poor use of scarce transportation resources in North Carolina. This from Kim Hunter, Southern Environmental Law Center attorney. And from Joe Malazzo, executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance Business Coalition. Communities in both Wake and Johnson counties have planned appropriately for decades for the completion of 540. And finally, a quote from Chris Johnston, who is Director of Economic Development for Johnston County. Obviously, they are unaware that Johnson County is going to increase its population over 300,000 in the next 10 years. It is locally needed. And under the heading of Seeking Damages comes the article, Miracle-Gro Sues Johnston County Marijuana Marketer. The lawn care giant behind Miracle-Gro has filed infringement allegations against a Triangle marketing firm, alleging that it's using its 70-year-old brand to promote marijuana companies. The Scotts Company, LLC, and OMS Investments, Incorporated, just lobbed a federal lawsuit at Miracle-Gro Marketing and Dropline Design, LLC, in Clayton. Proprietors Stephen and Victoria Toth are also named as defendants. In an email, Victoria Toth writes that the entities, both operating as Miracle-Gro Marketing, just became aware of the complaint and believe it is unjustified. She had no further comment. Miracle-Gro Marketing, according to its website, promotes the 420 industry, offering marketing and web development services to a variety of companies in the marijuana sector, from dispensaries to 420 event planners. The term 420 has its origins in a group of California high school students who met at 4:20 p.m. to smoke pot, and the term has grown since then. Scotts Miracle-Gro, owned by OMS Investments and licensed by the Scotts Company, has built its reputation up over time, first using the Miracle-Gro mark in 1951, the suit claims. And it says Miracle-Gro Marketing's alleged use of its trademarks diminishes their value. Defendant's improper conduct is knowing, intentional, and designed to trade on the reputation that Scotts Miracle-Gro has developed through many decades of successful promotion and sales of its superior products, the suit claims, alleging irreparable harm unless the Clayton companies are forced to stop using the mark. Plaintiffs are asking for judgment, forcing defendants to stop using the mark and destroy all allegedly infringing materials. And under the heading of Case Closed, Durham defense contractor settles a fraud case against former employee. 4 months in, and a Durham defense contractor has already reached a settlement with a former employee it had accused of perpetrating a fraud to secure intellectual property rights. Nuvotronics, now owned by Cubic Corporation, had filed a patent infringement suit February 28th against Masoud Barroz and Barroz's company, Component Z of Apex. In an order signed June 28th by U.S. District Judge Louise Flanagan, the case was dismissed with prejudice. The court's been advised that the parties have settled all matters in controversy among them, Flanagan's order reads. No settlement terms were disclosed, and attorneys didn't immediately return inquiries requesting more details. In its initial suit, Nuvotronics claimed that when it hired Barroz as a consultant in 2016, Barroz was prohibited from incorporating his pre-existing intellectual property into his work for the company. Barroz violated this agreement almost immediately, the suit alleged. Barroz's violation contaminated Nuvotronics' intellectual property, and Nuvotronics was forced to take remedial measures to reduce its possible exposure to claims by Barroz. Next on our technology and transportation page comes the article, Amazon site boosts Durham. The sprawling East Durham delivery station, hidden near the water tower off North Hoover Road, has actually been open since last year, putting out tens of thousands of packages each day. But July 2nd was its official ribbon cutting, and with the celebration came James Shively, Regional Director for Amazon's Last Mile Logistics. "I want to welcome you to our Amazon delivery station," he told the crowd. "It's the second such delivery station in Durham, and it might not be the last." While he declined to speculate, Shively didn't rule out the possibility of additional facilities, saying there are already 100 like these across the country. "And we haven't hit holiday season," pointed out Representative Zach Hawkins at the celebration to thank the company for bringing jobs to Durham. The site is supporting 385 permanent full and part-time jobs, critical, he says, to his district. He points to the $15 per hour Amazon minimum wage and the benefits, including paternity leave. "And it's a huge opportunity for people to pick up a second job if they need it," he says. The site is also supporting local entrepreneurs through its Delivery Service Partnership Program, where independent contractors can build independent companies delivering packages for Amazon, making anywhere from $18 to $25 per hour, Shively says. Jasper Lee, 30-year military veteran, is one of those independent delivery service providers, launching his own business, JEMG Supply Chain, in 2018, with 4 vans and 8 employees. "Today, it's 33 vans and more than 65 employees," he says. "I'm part of that last mile," he says. "Me and my company deliver packages to customers, thanks to Amazon, and we're bringing jobs into the community." At the conclusion of the event, Amazon had presents for the youngest attendees. Children from the local Boys and Girls Club treated to $10,000 worth of STEM merchandise. Amazon is in the process of building an even bigger facility, a massive warehouse distribution center in Garner. Now we turn the page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and what we find is on healthcare and education. Under the heading of partnership comes the article, Liquidia Strikes New Deal with GSK. As a Triangle company rapidly approaches filing for approval of its first drug, it has inked a deal with GlaxoSmithKline to bring more drugs up the pipeline behind it. Morrisville-based Liquidia Technologies has announced an expanded collaboration agreement with GSK, providing the rights to develop additional therapeutics using Liquidia's PRINT particle manufacturing platform. Prior to the agreement, GSK retained exclusive rights to develop and commercialize any PRINT-based therapeutic, except for Liquidia's current lead candidate, LIQ861, a treatment for pulmonary arterial hypertension. Under the terms of the new deal, Liquidia has rights to develop and commercialize up to 3 additional inhalation therapeutics using the platform. The deal provides that Liquidia can also pursue additional therapeutics subject to GSK's approval. For future drug candidates under the deal, GSK maintains a right of first negotiation prior to Liquidia entering into a license agreement with another party. The agreement also carries milestone and royalty obligations due to GSK, beginning with the initiation of a Phase 3 clinical trial. Precise financial terms of the deal were not disclosed. The news builds on Liquidia's existing momentum coming off positive Phase 3 data of LIQ861 in April. Based on the results, the company is hoping to file a new drug application by the end of this year. Liquidia CEO Neil Fowler says the deal is part of the company's plan to expand its pipeline and drug potential and was not related to the timing of the new drug application. Our long-term plan is to build a robust pipeline of differentiated products addressing unmet needs, he says. That's something we're always just seeking to do, and this agreement just happened to be finalized at this time. The increased drug potential for the company comes at an important time as it seeks additional financing to fund its commercialization efforts next year. And also on this page, Falwell spars with UNC Health over health plan counteroffer. On the eve of the state treasurer Dale Falwell's deadline to participate in his new state employee health plan, UNC Health offered a counterproposal that relit tensions between the parties and further solidified it and other hospitals' stance against signing on to the plan. In late 2018, Falwell launched his Clear Pricing Project, a revision of the state health plan, or SHP, which provides health care coverage for more than 727,000 state employees, retirees, and beneficiaries. The project, set to take effect January the 1st, would transition the plan to a reference-based government pricing model based on a percentage of Medicare rates. The deadline for providers to sign onto his contract or be left out of network was midnight July 2nd. Many of the state's providers have resisted Falwell's plans. The North Carolina Healthcare Association said Falwell's plan will squeeze rural hospitals. State health plan officials say they are still processing the contracts received and do not have specific information regarding the number of providers or hospitals that joined at this time. They say exact numbers will likely be available later this month. In its opposition to the plan, UNC Health presented a counterproposal to state officials detailing a plan which relies on a value-based care system. In a letter sent to D. Jones, the executive director of the state health plan, UNC Healthcare CEO Dr. Wesley Burks said the system hopes its proposal will satisfy many of the concerns addressed by Falwell's plan, such as price transparency, while still being broadly welcomed by other providers in the state. As stated in past conversations, we're not in a position to sign the SHP contract, Burks said. The reductions will be significantly detrimental to our overall system, and more importantly, we believe this plan will be detrimental to the overall health of the state employees and citizens of North Carolina we serve every day. And under the heading of Purple Squirrels comes the article, NCSU Internet Creates a Divided Hiring Process. A recent report of an NC State University has found the advent of the Internet has not necessarily translated to an easier time finding a better job. Steve McDonald, a professor of sociology and lead author of new research on hiring, says technology has created black holes for low-wage job candidates and curated a headhunting process for higher-wage jobs. The Internet has massively expanded access that workers have to information about job opportunities, he says, but expanded access to information does not appear to have translated into greater opportunities for low-wage workers to be hired. Researchers found that for lower-wage positions, the increase in use of online job sites has created hyper-competition for even entry-level positions, with candidates submitting applications into a black hole and seldom hearing back. But it's different for high-wage positions, where employers increasingly seek out qualified candidates, so-called purple squirrels, because of their rarity. And under the heading Triangle Impact comes the article, Medicaid Expansion Could Bring Jobs to North Carolina. While still hotly contested in the state, a new report says Medicaid expansion could have major economic impact, creating more than 9,000 jobs in the Triangle. According to a report by the Cohn Health Foundation and the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust, through researchers at George Washington University, expanding Medicaid in North Carolina would create more than 37,000 jobs by providing insurance to about 365,000 more people. North Carolina is one of 14 states that has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Almost 1 million residents between 19 and 64 are uninsured. In addition to new jobs, the researchers estimate additional business growth would exceed $11.7 billion between 2020 and 2022. Dr. Laura Gerald, president of the Reynolds Charitable Trust, says expanding Medicaid is a clear-cut positive for the state. This is an opportunity to get more back than you put in, she says. If you look at it in any terms, it's a bonanza, a boost for the state. And finally on this page, under the heading of Skills Gap, comes the article, Startup Hopes Video Game Sparks Interest in Chemistry. A Triangle startup is hoping to rectify a skills gap of employees with chemistry backgrounds by bringing educational video games into high schools throughout the state. Plasma Games, founded by Hunter Moore, an MBA graduate from UNC Chapel Hill, says the idea for the company is to address a growing need for talent in the life sciences sector, which is stymied by a lack of interest and adequate resources. The highest-paid college majors are all chemistry-based, he says. Because the high-paid jobs are chemistry-based, there are no chemistry teachers left. According to Moore, less than 50% of chemistry teachers have a degree in chemistry, and can sometimes be English or history teachers dragged into the roles. To supplement that, Moore and his startup have developed a video game in which game mechanics and features are based on chemistry, educating students through an interactive and entertaining experience. Next, we briefly turn to the restaurants and retail page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Hope Valley comes the article, Sensory Deprivation Comes to Durham. Durham's Hope Valley Commons is landing a new tenant when Salty Waters Float Spa opens by the end of August. The float spa will feature two flotation pods, as well as an impulse 3-in-1 infrared sauna and an on-site massage therapist. But what exactly is floating, and what are the benefits to this new experience? Floating involves lying in about 10 inches of a solution of water and Epsom salt at skin temperature. Also known as sensory deprivation, some of the health benefits it boasts include helping to lower stress and high blood pressure, heal injured muscles and tendons, provide a better night's rest and improve symptoms from fibromyalgia and arthritis. Salty Water Float Spa will offer free floats 2 weeks prior to the grand opening. Hope Valley Commons is located at the intersection of Highways 54 and 751. The shopping center is also home to a Harris Teeter grocery store, Japan Express, Marco's Pizza, Sweet Charlie's, and Walgreens. Next, we turn briefly to the On Business page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of New Owners comes the article, Hotel on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill Sold. A hotel on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill has new owners, with a new look and a new name soon to follow. Graduate Hotels, a hotel collection under Adventurous Journey Capital Partners of Chicago, has acquired the Franklin Hotel from Wintergreen Hospitality. The property, located at 311 West Franklin Street, sold for approximately $20.6 million, according to Orange County property records. It has 67 guest rooms and was opened in 2007. The new owners will begin renovations in January. After construction ends in April, the hotel will be known as the Graduate Chapel Hill. They've had an interest in Chapel Hill for some time, Jay Patel, president of Wintergreen Hospitality, says of the new owners. Graduate is a national collection of hotels with locations in multiple college towns such as Charlottesville, Virginia, Oxford, Mississippi, and Athens, Georgia. The hotels seek to allow guests and locals to rekindle the spirit of their alma mater, according to the Graduate's website. It's a rapidly expanding brand with 15 hotels open across the country and another 16 set to open by the end of 2020. Wintergreen, which owned another nearby property off Franklin Street, had intended to take a longer-term approach to the Franklin, Patel says, but the Graduate approached with an enticing deal offering a solid return on his firm's 10-year investment in the property. It allowed us to have a win-win, Patel says. We could focus on our other site and at the same time deliver a really strong return on the Franklin Hotel to our investors. Patel believes he's leaving the Franklin in good hands. They've got a very specific national vision, but they'll still be able to tie it into the local specifics of this market, he says. Watching what they're doing in other markets around the country and how they conduct themselves, how much they invest in their hotels, and how they execute their brand, I think that's the only way this deal would have come down as a result of cultivating that relationship. Next, we turn to this week's cover story from the Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled, Ask Bio's Tumultuous Ride to Achieve Unicorn Status. Nearly two decades ago, Sheila McHale heard an unusual pitch from a UNC Chapel Hill professor that would change her professional career and shape a burgeoning industry promising to treat rare diseases across the world. Speaking as a guest lecturer about startups, McHale met Jude Samulski, the inventor of the leading method of modern gene therapy, who was struggling to even allow the university to let him start his own spin-out company. I won't be able to pay you because I'll probably never be able to raise money. People think this is sort of ludicrous, he told her. But if we're successful, we'll change the world. And so Asclepios Biopharmaceutical was born in 2001, bringing together McHale's experience as a life sciences lawyer and Samulski's years of research. The company, commonly referred to as AskBio, develops and licenses a gene therapy platform first developed by Samulski using adeno-associated virus called AAVs as a vehicle to treat genetic diseases. The company floundered in the initial years, trying to survive in a market that simply was not interested in its science. Its founders went without salaries for more than 10 years, with McHale, 52, even running her law practice in her spare time to pay her mortgage. We were very creative. We were like wizards in non-dilutive financing, she says. Nobody had money in the industry, so it was kind of, hey, I have this and you have that. Let's put it together and see what we can do. Over time, the markets began to recognize the breakthroughs happening in gene therapy, such as kids with muscular dystrophy who couldn't walk up a staircase, now playing Little League Baseball, or the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's approval of a cure for inherited blindness. Thanks to a series of promising developments followed by the loosening of purse strings on Wall Street, money started flowing into gene therapy fields in the past couple of years. AskBio was right in the middle of it. On April the 11th, a small research-heavy company working out of a nondescript building in Research Triangle Park closed on $235 million in financing, the largest haul of capital in one round by a North Carolina life sciences company. As a side note, Cary-based Epic Games and Charlotte-based Avid Exchange raised more money, but both are in the information technology space. Following capital close, industry observers pegged AskBio's pre-money valuation to be in excess of $800 million. Only two investors made that big of a bet: Vita Ventures of Boston and TPG Capital of Fort Worth, Texas. We tend to make large investments, and to some extent, the field has matured enough now you can make some scale investments beyond traditional biotech investments, said John Schilling, a partner at TPG Capital. There has now been sufficient maturation in the industry and sufficient development of the science to justify it at this point. If things go right and research keeps kicking the ball forward toward the goal line, AskBio could soon become one of the most prominent unicorns in the triangle. The unicorn moniker is stamped on startups and research-heavy enterprises with a valuation in excess of $1 billion. For founders Samulski, McHale, and Xiao Xiao, who collectively still hold the majority of the company, they're reminded of the early days almost every day. "We should not be here today," McHale says. "We were just too darn stubborn." Damaged or mutant genes in human DNA have long been known to be the culprit behind a list of diseases and disorders affecting millions of people. For years, scientists have known that if mutant genes could be fixed, then many of these diseases could be treated at a molecular level or even cured. The problem, says the 65-year-old Samulski, is that researchers struggle to find a way to smuggle correcting genes past the body's immune system, which would reject any possible solutions. "Our body was doing what it was engineered to do. If foreign material got in," he says, "it limited it very efficiently." In the late 1970s, Samulski began his doctoral work in medical microbiology and immunology at the University of Florida. In 4 years of work, he demonstrated that AAV could be used as a lasting delivery mechanism for non-AAV genes, opening the door to the possibility of researchers hijacking AAV to treat a long list of rare genetic diseases. "When we used AAV, we encountered a completely different paradigm when we deposited the gene," he says. "We'd look every 2 weeks to see if and when the immune system would kick it out. It never happened." In the 40 years since his discovery, AAV technology has risen to the forefront of modern gene therapy, with the method Samulski patented becoming widely considered the safest strategy. Dr. Guangping Gao, the director of Gene Therapy Center and Vector Core at the University of Massachusetts, says, behind the recent explosion of interest in gene therapy is AAV technology and Samulski. The reason the gene therapy field is growing fast is because of the rapid development of the AAV-based gene therapy platform, Gao says. Dr. Jude Samulski is considered the pioneer and grandfather of AAV. He was the one that developed the vector system and made many of the contributions. In fact, at one time, Samulski held a patent for all non-AAV genes being inserted into AAV, which has since expired, and we would be considered wildly vague in today's industry. The success of his method has brought him countless laurels and even invitations for meetings with individuals such as Pope Francis, the Chinese Minister of Health, and the King of Spain. "When I was eating pizza in Pizza Hut and talking about making a viral vector, if I had any idea of what was going to happen, I probably would have gotten nervous and walked away from it," Samulski says. But Samulski says he never considered stopping and remained dedicated to bringing his concept to life one way or another, even when it meant leaving the comfort of laboratories and fighting it out in boardrooms. If I was honestly looking for a low point, it might be when you realize the academics can't do any more than provide you a place to do research, he said. Universities don't make drugs. They ask questions and explore new technologies. But when you want to take it across the line, you have to hand it to someone and step back to your place, or you have to transform who you are and what you're doing to someone else. That's kind of the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde between academics and companies. And though the company currently enjoys its watershed moment with a full war chest, its path almost collapsed multiple times. The biggest hurdle came from an early tragedy in the gene therapy industry. In 1999, Jesse Gelsinger, an 18-year-old with ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency, died from gene therapy treatment at the University of Pennsylvania. Despite the incident being attributed to several of the factors, and based on a different gene therapy approach, the death scared off everyone but the scientists who truly understood the research. It gave a black eye to everyone doing gene therapy, Simulski says. Essentially, they didn't distinguish between an AAV gene therapy approach and a nanovirus gene therapy approach. McHale says following the death, the gene therapy field all but shuttered, with investors and regulators refusing to go near the science. It was so frustrating because I don't think the science is different fundamentally than it was a decade ago, and we could have had these impacts on patients' health over a decade ago, she says. For instance, with muscular dystrophy, there's a whole generation of boys that we couldn't help because there's a window when the muscle deteriorates too much for gene therapy to work. Starting a company specializing in gene therapy just 2 years after the Gelsinger death was less than ideal, but she says they believed in the work. During the first years, McHale says, it was nearly impossible to get people to even hear their pitch. I was the ugly girl at the prom, she said. We'd go to these investor conferences and nobody would talk to me. They'd walk away from me. I used to call venture capitalists to get appointments and they wouldn't even say goodbye. They'd just hang up when they heard gene therapy. Simulski says AskBio launched at the same time that a host of other companies launched, such as Cerigene and Avigen in California and Targeted Genetics in Seattle. He says each of those companies died from a lack of funding. To survive past their initial $5 million, Simulski and McHale said they went to elaborate methods, including coming up with creative descriptions of their work to get into investor boardrooms before broaching the subject. We came up with an interesting approach. Nanoparticles were in vogue then, so we called AAV biological nanoparticles because they actually fit that definition. So we'd call them BNPs and trademark that so we could actually get through the door to talk to someone. But a massive piece of the company's survival came from families of patients with rare diseases and foundations willing to bet on the science, with some parents even holding bake sales and raffles to raise funding for the company. We had one parent of a muscular dystrophy child who was very generous because we told him we weren't sure we'd be able to advance the science in time for his son. But he still put money into AskBio, McHale says. A lot of people are extremely generous. You see a lot of ugliness in our political environment and in a capitalist society. You think it's all about money, money, money. But there are a lot of people out there who think beyond themselves. I want to make contributions, even when it won't help them or their kids. Included in the patchwork of grassroots fundraising was a small innovation grant, and small innovation grants was a $1.6 million award in 2004 from the Muscular Dystrophy Association, its first in history. McHale and Simulski says venture capital and big pharma began sniffing around the gene therapy industry again in the late 2000s. But we're still hesitant to become involved, especially because many of the gene therapy's one-time cures represented threats to the revenue streams on which pharmaceutical companies rely. In recent years, a massive explosion of interest has occurred, accelerated by two drugs receiving FDA approval. AveXis's Zolgensma, which cures spinal muscular atrophy, and Spark Therapeutics' Luxturna, which cures inherited blindness, both based on technology from AskBio. Even AskBio joined the feeding frenzy of gene therapy monetization by spinning off a muscular dystrophy therapy company called Bamboo Therapeutics. In 2016, AskBio sold Bamboo to Pfizer in an $835 million deal that brought $150 million upfront to AskBio and its founders. And that may just have been the catalyst for the investment community to legitimize Samulski and McHale's work. I tried so hard in 2015 to get Bamboo financed, but we were just ahead of the curve, she says. I went out to Wall Street, and they just kept telling me it will not work. I was crazy. Go away. This was the biggest heartbreak of my life. I couldn't get it financed. Despite that, Samulski credits McHale for bringing AskBio through its most difficult financial challenges, saying that without her ingenuity, the company likely would have stalled countless times. My new term for her is she's a structural engineer, he says. She can engineer structures that let these things be successful that you just can't imagine. Everything we would confront as a bottleneck or problem, she would figure out how to make it work. I've never seen anyone be so creative. I learned to not say, "Are you crazy?" anymore, because she's done it enough times. Buoyed by the capital rise, AskBio is also sitting on top of a library of AAV vectors, 10 spinouts, and more than 500 patents. The cumulative volume of intellectual property at the company is bringing substantial license revenue. While McHale could not disclose exact amounts, she characterized it as multiple hundreds of millions in license revenue over the next few years. And as venture capitalists and private equity players become more interested in funding startups based on AAV technology research, AskBio's potential source of revenue are expected to grow exponentially. Schilling, who co-leads TPG's healthcare team, says the recent investment into AskBio is not only a sign of trust in the company's financial future, but recognition of a changing priority in the drug industry. "We're moving into a new era of pharmaceutical development," he says. "We're transitioning away from small molecular therapies, which by their natures have relatively limited specificity. So now we're harnessing the power of a lot of highly developed systems. Those systems, specifically cell and gene therapies, have been a long-standing interest to the firm, according to Schilling, but it has only recently gotten involved. AskBio is the first investment TBG has made into the gene therapy space, though Schilling points to their investment in Allogene Therapeutics as a similar venture. What we're trying to do is partner with true scientific innovators and business leaders with the aim of developing transformative therapies that will represent quantum leaps in both science and patient care ultimately, he says. AskBio, Schilling says, fits the bill in every respect, but he notes there are always risks in drug development. For TBG, what makes AskBio a safer bet is their constant revenue stream from licenses, royalties from legacy companies, as well as their robust clinical pipeline and manufacturing capabilities. As with any innovative therapies, there are risks, he says. However, what's attractive about AskBio is that there are multiple ways to drive value. Though the new renaissance of gene therapy seems to be in full swing, the industry and AskBio still have challenges. Now, money is pouring into the sector and everyone's very happy, but I don't think that's going to be that easy, McHale says. There are going to be some roadblocks and some setbacks because there always are to evolving science. First and foremost, says Gal, is a struggle for the most gene therapy companies to even manufacture enough therapeutics to register for pivotal trials, much less successfully commercialize products. But AskBio leads the industry in the sector with a manufacturing system that investors see as yet another avenue of financial success by providing manufacturing services across the industry. AskBio also lacks real completion in the space, with barely a handful of other companies offering platform-level services like its own, such as AveXis, which licenses from AskBio, and Spark Therapeutics. Regardless, the company believes there's plenty of unmet diseases left for the industry in its early days. We don't think there's anybody who could threaten our progression, McGill says. I don't look at the world as a zero-sum game. I look at it as the pie can be much bigger. Perhaps the bigger risk comes from the uncertainty regarding many of the lasting effects of therapeutics, even once successfully complete trials. We think this is long-term, or even lifelong, but we don't know for certain, she says. It would be very devastating if someone was treated for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and then the therapeutic wears off. You've given them a gift, and then taken it away. The problem is further complicated with today's bodies, with the body's neutralizing antibodies, which form after being exposed to AAV and make repeated administrations hopeless. In fact, the company reports that 25% of its trial patients already have an existing resistance, excluding a massive chunk from the potentially life-saving therapies. McHale says that not only is the company committed to finding ways around those unacceptable problems, but is constantly looking to reduce the cost of the drugs as they are developed, and she does not want to see a world where cures for genetic diseases are limited to a more affluent population. And as gene therapy research progresses, the treatments will invariably have to face the prospect of going against more common yet complex diseases such as Parkinson's or heart disease. Treating those with a one-time therapy may be a godsend for patients, but the pharmaceutical companies that have built their business on recurring revenue from those diseases may be less than opportunistic in funding research to nullify them. McHale also worries about more companies entering the space. Whereas companies like AskBio have carefully toiled for years, she says the recent success in the industry is driving more research and funding into the sector, some with more opportunistic intentions and recklessness that could lead to another death that stalls the industry. McHale and Samulski still believe the industry is coming out of its darker days, and with a plethora of patients showing miraculous recovery for the first time in history, they believe enough proof is out there to keep surviving. Honestly, I think we've been through the worst of it, she says. We've been through hell, and as a consequence, I'm not scared of failure or what could happen because we have the understanding of the science and know how to work through problems. And with a war chest behind them, AskBio believes that nearly two decades in, it has finally reached its launching point. We're like race cars that have been revving up our engines, who have finally received the green light to begin the race, McHale told her employees during a company picnic in June. Our technology has made the blind see. It has made the lame walk. It will make the deaf hear. Now a couple of short articles as we near the end of the program. Under the article, under the heading of Helping Out, comes the article, Have a Drink for a Good Cause at Glenwood this month. In an event to raise funds for the North Carolina Partnership for Child Nutrition, Durham Distillery will team up with Dram and Draft to toast the distillery's latest release, Conniption Gin Rosé Spritz Canned Cocktail. The July 18th event will take place on the rooftop of the newly constructed One Glenwood building at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and Hillsborough Street. Wegmans, which opens soon in Raleigh, will bring seasonal bites for guests. The NCPCN is a nonprofit that was created to enable a positive and sustainable impact on school nutrition in the Tar Heel State. And under the heading of Big Season comes the article, Deepak Sets Records for Attendance and Sold-Out Shows. If you tried in vain to grab a Hamilton ticket this past November, it may come as no surprise that the Durham Performing Arts Center, or Deepak, recorded record-high numbers of guests and sold-out performances for its most recent season. Attendance for the 2018-19 season reached 536,710 guests, with 163 total sold-out shows throughout the season, Deepak reported on July 2nd. Attendance increased 15% from the 17-18 season. The numbers may have been boosted by Hamilton, which ran at Deepak from November the 6th through December the 2nd and was the venue's top-selling musical of the season. The hit show about founding father Alexander Hamilton, along with other popular musicals such as Dear Evan Hansen and Cats, sold out over 100 of the season's 240 shows and events. Other top-selling performances included concerts by the rock band Widespread Panic, stand-up comedy by Aziz Ansari, and comedic act Madea's Farewell Play Tour. The venue is owned by the City of Durham and operated by Professional Facilities Management and Niederlander, a theater management company based out of New York. Next, we turn to the Viewpoints page at the end of the Triangle Business Journal, and we have the guest columnist written this week by John Hood. Hood is chairman of the Raleigh-based John Locke Foundation, and his article is entitled, NC Community Colleges Offer Great Value. Many political and education leaders in North Carolina say that our economy would be better off if our level of educational attainment was higher. They're probably right about that, as long as their definition of educational attainment is sufficiently broad. According to the most recent data from the U.S. Census Bureau, about 30% of North Carolinians aged 25 and over have bachelor's or graduate degrees. That's up from 23% in the year 2000. Another 9% or so have two-year associate degrees, up from 7% in 2000. Did all of the remaining three-fifths of North Carolina's 25-plus population make it no further than high school? Not at all. Some 22% attended college for a while, but never finished their programs. If state policymakers are worried about insufficient attainment, the experience of this some college population deserves closer scrutiny. Education is, among other things, an investment in human capital. To the extent you obtain useful knowledge and skills, the value of your work rises. To the extent other people obtain useful knowledge and skills, you can benefit too as co-workers or as purchasers of their goods and services. Taxpayers can help finance the formation of both physical and human capital, but there are at least two critical differences between the two. One has to do with identity. Roads, bridges, and other infrastructure are fixed in place and can be owned and operated by governments, although they don't have to be. But in a free society, human capital is always private and usually mobile. The other big difference is that education is only partially an economic investment. It has multiple goals. One such goal can be to foster good citizenship. Future voters should possess basic knowledge about history, science, civics, and related fields. This was Thomas Jefferson's original justification for public education. Quote, "It's an axiom in my mind that our liberty can never be safe, but in the hands of the people themselves," unquote, he wrote in a 1786 letter to George Washington, "and even better that it be in the hands of," quote, "people with a certain degree of instruction," unquote. With regard to higher education, students sometimes take courses or even get degrees for reasons other than maximizing future earnings. Some just enjoy learning. For others, they make a conscious choice to pursue a relatively low-paying career because they believe it will make them happier or serve some greater good. I say all of that as a necessary prelude to this observation. If the goal of raising educational attainment is to enhance human capital, thus boosting incomes and living standards across North Carolina's economy, then it would be a mistake to focus too narrowly on university campuses. Of those 22% of North Carolina adults who consume some higher education but don't possess a degree, a significant percentage started out at a four-year institution when they should have gone to community college instead. It would have cost less. They might well have been more successful by staying closer to home. And if they had completed associate degrees, they might well have been better off than if they had completed BA or BS degrees. Did that last assertion surprise you? I can back it up. Several recent studies have tracked income data for workers of varying educational backgrounds and careers over long periods of time. While on average, those with at least bachelor's degrees have higher lifetime earnings than those without them, the difference is largely attributable to undergraduate and graduate degrees in business and STEM fields, that's science, technology, engineering, and math. Lifetime incomes for those with bachelor's degrees in liberal arts and humanities are not significantly higher than for those with associate degrees. By no means am I denigrating the study of liberal arts and humanities. Their value is more than pecuniary. But if we're talking about labor market returns, let's make sure young people and the not-so-young people who make education policy in North Carolina don't overlook the great potential of proximate, affordable, community colleges. Last, we turn to the editor's notebook of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the article is Slowdown in VC Deals Point to Nervous Market. With the second quarter under our belts in a couple of weeks, we'll get the latest venture capital activity numbers to determine whether the slowdown in the first quarter is the beginning of a trend. As the charts below point out, the U.S. venture capital funding and deal activity fell quite appreciably during the first quarter, with the mega rounds of venture capital down from record levels in 2018, but still proceeding pretty high in terms of historic patterns. However, the biggest worry among Triangle entrepreneurs should be the fall in seed funding. During first quarter, seed stage deals accounted for only 24% of the total VC market, down from the third quarter of 2017 high of 36%. While North Carolina still struggles to crack the top five metro areas for venture capital funding, alternative financing through private equity players has been robust in the past year. The cover story this week on Ask Bio serves as a good example of that. But the bigger worry among the companies starting up in artificial intelligence, fintech, and infotech is whether the financial market's appetite to complete new deals is waning. That's what makes the second quarter numbers so important. Now, some of the graphical data referenced in his article was the U.S. financing trends, the number of deals in quarter one of 18, 1524, quarter two, 1639, quarter three, 1427, quarter four, 1328, and then the first quarter of 19, 1279 deals. And the funding, the venture capital funding in quarter one of 18 was $22.8 billion. It rose to a high in the fourth quarter of 18 of $38.7 billion. And then for the first quarter of this year was only $24.6 billion. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.